drifting through the front fence. As we set off, I thought, here I am, with my father, at the beginning. I am Lisa, and I have a father, and we are driving between the outlines of dark hills, inside a strong wind perfumed with dry grasses. I told the story of myself to myself. I didn't know what the story would become, but I knew it would be something, maybe something big. I was too scared to talk. It was almost pitch black inside the car except for the dashboard lights, the trembling needles and round instruments that were nicer than those in other cars I'd seen. Their movements were precise, and they gave off a whiter glow. His kind of driving felt heavy and light at the same time. The car solid, fastened to the road, but accelerating quickly with no resistance. He turned on music, loud, a Hard Day's Night. Ribbons of cool night air slipped in from the outside and mingled with the heat from the vents. I used the lever on the side of the seat to bring it up and forward as far as possible. My butt and thighs grew hot. The leather had small puncture holes like tiny dots. That must be where the heat came through. We drove over Highway 280 on Sand Hill Road, then into the dark hills where there was only the smell of the grasses and far away the jagged ridge of redwood trees that met the bright night sky. My father didn't speak or look at me. It was hard to keep thinking of things to talk about. I wanted to be close with him all at once, to feel the way I imagined other children felt with their fathers. I wanted a conflagration of talk, of questions, of noticing. I'd been waiting for so long, and now that we were here, it felt too late. Near his busy silence, I felt a new kind of dissolution. I was starting to disappear. I noticed details about him with exact focus, but had difficulty locating myself. I watched his hands on the steering wheel. He had smart fingers with fine black hair that grew straight on the first joint after the knuckle. His thumbs had wide fingernails. Like me, he bit his nails and the skin on the sides. His jaw clenched on and off, making a rippling pattern in his skin, like a fish beneath the surface of a pond. I swallowed air, worried that when my voice came out, it would squeak, or about the very real possibility that he would not respond. I was filled with what I might say, if he asked me a question. How I didn't do the Pledge of Allegiance at school because I said I was a Buddhist. How Mrs. Keatsman twisted her ring. How my mother let me stare on the steep hills of Portola Valley when I was six. How I'd guessed the number of corn kernels in the jar. How I was practicing to do the leap like the girl in the magazine. How, when I was younger, to pass time while my mother was waiting in line at the bank or looking at a painting at the art museum, I'd done headstands on the hard ground, painless, popping up to vertical in one motion. The moment was too fragile for these stories. I didn't want to break it. How was your day? I finally asked, my fingers shaking and my stomach a nausea creeping up toward my throat. What would we have for dinner? What did he eat? Okay, thanks, he said. It didn't make him look. He lapsed back into silence and didn't look at me for the rest of the drive. It was not enough. It was not enough. The canopy of gnarled oak branches over the road flared into view and then went dark as we passed. A single car came toward us, moving down the hill. My father toggled a rod beside the steering wheel, and it gave a satisfying click. The headlights dimmed. Once we passed, he did it again, this time restoring the forest to light. I'd never noticed anyone dim lights for an oncoming car, and I felt a burst of affection for him, seized with an idea of his fineness. When I told my mother about it the next day, she said everyone did that. Everyone dimmed the brights for oncoming traffic. We turned onto Mountain Home Road, then onto a road with white pillars on either side, cracked and leaning, silvery in the darkness. And then we were approaching it. The face of the house, the flagpole, the gate, the house glowing white. In the open courtyard, two crates the size of small cars held giant trees shaped like bonsai, with clouds of spongy-looking foliage suspended off trunks that grew in an angle. I followed him to the front door under a high curving arch made of other rooms and suites that connected to more of the house on the other side. The front door was made of a rough wood that would give me a splinter if I ran my palm along its surface, much larger and heavier than I remembered from when I'd visited before. Inside, he flicked on a switch. The flick sound echoed against the tile floor. In the dim light, I saw the grand staircase with its twisting banister disappearing upward and a motorcycle leaning against the wall in the huge entryway, the body black leather and bright chrome, double-lobed like a wasp. "Is that yours?" I asked. It hinted at a different life.
"Yeah," he said. "But I stopped riding it. Want to take a hot tub later?"
So that's what the suit was for. When I asked, he showed me to a high-ceilinged bathroom I'd never seen before, that would, in future years, come to define my idea of luxury. A disconnected cistern mounted far above the toilet, a hanging lamp in the shape of a three-dimensional star. Moorish tiles around the sink patterned in thick and colorful geometries, and bronze faucet handles shaped like wings. The room was dim and echoey, the ceiling so high you could hardly see it. I looked around for the flush and found a chain with a white ceramic knob, and when I pulled, the water came rushing down fiercely into the toilet. I followed him into the ballroom, the ceiling ribbed with dark beams. In the center of the room was a glossy black piano with its lid lifted, a lamp, and a black leather couch. The furniture was large, but looked small in this room. In the next room was a fireplace with a high arch, beneath which I could walk without stooping. Beyond that, a pantry with empty white shelves that went all the way to the ceiling. Through a swinging door, we stepped into the huge white kitchen. I remember the progression of vast rooms, the smell of mold and decay, from the time I'd visited before. But that time, there had been no motorcycle or piano. My father reached into the fridge and pulled out two wooden bowls containing salads and a bottle of juice murky with brown silt. There was nothing else inside but clean white shelves. He poured us each a glass to the brim, far more than I could drink, then filled a huge plate with the salads, piling them side by side, one shredded carrots with currants, the other bulgur wheat with parsley.
"I'm going to give you some of both, all right?"
I nodded. No one had ever put so much food in front of me. Did he expect me to eat all of this?
"Now this," he said, holding up a rectangular bottle of green glass, "is the best olive oil in the world."
I didn't usually like olive oil, but I let him draw a green line on the salads. He handed me an enormous fork. The salads were cold and tasted of nothing, just their own rough textures. We sat side by side on stools at the island, facing the stove. He read a newspaper while he ate. After a while, he asked if I was done, and when I said yes, he took my plate and glass, both still mostly full, and put them in the sink. He didn't say anything about how much I'd eaten.
"Let's change into our swimsuits," he said.
We went through a different door to a hallway and another whole set of empty rooms and a staircase with steps painted white, the paint wearing off in places.
"We're going to have to make a run for it," he said.
There was no way to turn off the light from the top of the stairs. He flicked off the switch, and we were plunged into darkness. The stairs creaked. I hugged the wall, feeling my way up.
"Boo!"
my father said. Then ghost-like, "Ooh, ooh." At the top, I followed him to a door that led to a spindly-covered wooden balcony that overlooked the courtyard with the boxed trees. The balcony trembled with the weight of our steps.
"This thing's falling apart," he said.
We walked along it to a screen door that creaked when he opened it.
"The in-law suite," he said.
"What's an in-law?" I asked.
"A person you want to put somewhere far away."
It was a whole apartment. It smelled like the rest of the house.
old carpet and mold and wood and paint. I followed him up some steps and down a small hallway into a big, empty room. His room. There was a mattress on the floor, and a huge television on a metal rack.
"And this is your bed," he said,
showing me to a room off his. There was a red shag carpet, and a futon on the floor made up with sheets tucked into its sides, and a pillow. The small, somewhat furnished apartment, somewhere inside the cavernous, echoing, and empty house, gave the feeling of camping. He left me alone to change. When I came out, he was waiting, barefoot, in shorts and a t-shirt. He handed me a big black towel, much bigger and plusher than other towels. Everything he owned was big. The trees in their crates, the front door, the fireplace, refrigerator, forks, and television. Near the stairwell, I noticed the same elevator I'd seen before. It looked like a plain doorway, except for the two black buttons beside it. I asked him if we could take it, and he said yes, we could. It wouldn't move until the outer door was closed and the latch was closed on the inner accordion door, the diamond-shaped bars traveling with us, a buzzing sound coming from somewhere inside the cage. The wall slipped by, as if it were the thing moving, and not us. It was like a little prison that held you and released you somewhere else. When it stopped, and he reached over to unfasten the metal hatch, his arm brushed mine. I pushed open the door and leapt out into the hallway. Past the asphalt, down the hill to the pool, the sharp, stiff curls of dry oak leaves dug into my feet. The wind ruffled the leaves of huge trees around us. The path on the lawn sloped down to the pool, and beside it, the hot tub. In the moonlight, I could see the hot tub was clean, but the pool was filled with leaves. My father took off his t-shirt and slipped into the hot tub. "Ah," he said, closing his eyes. I got in and said it too. "Ah." I was sitting on the bench across from him. I leaned my head back. Above me, the whole vast sky was covered in stars. They ripped at my heart. I felt the cold wind on my face and listened to the crickets, the creaking of the trees. It was like being in the car with the top down and the heater on. The cold air, the hot water, two temperatures at once. We sat in silence, the bubbles and mist on the surface of the water. I dipped my head underwater. I thought about doing a handstand, but with the current from the jets and the cement benches and the possibility of hitting his legs, I decided not to. "All right, champ," he said. "Ready to get out?"
"Okay," I said. My fingers were wrinkled into hills. We wrapped our towels around us and walked back on the prickly ground. I felt that I was with him, and also alone. On the asphalt where the car was parked, he pointed up to the second floor on the corner.
"We should build a slide from the bedroom to the pool. What do you think?"
"Yes, I think we should, definitely," I said.
I wondered if it was just a joke. I hoped it was real. His house was crumbling in places and tended to in others, a configuration of attention and neglect I didn't understand. The toilets had rust-colored rings in the basins, and water dripped into the corner of a distant wing, while outside raspberries were trellised meticulously in the garden. He left the whole place empty, as if he didn't own it, but was a visitor or a squatter. When I asked him how many rooms there were, he said he didn't know. He hadn't set foot in most of them. Later, I explored. Rooms and suites and dusty doors swung open to more empty, dusty rooms, more tiled sinks and showers. Toward the back of the property was a huge building that looked to me like a church. It was meant to house a water tower. But inside, it was missing the cistern, had only circles cut out of wood at every story, empty in the center where the tank would have been. These outlines of circles were covered in leaves and bird poop and cobwebs, silvering with age, like the abandoned bones of a huge animal. The whole time he lived there, I don't think I visited every last room. A kind of magic, to have unconquered space, to be past a frontier. I found a tennis court beyond the pool, with vines clogging the surrounding fence, Roots warped and cracked through the quartz green surface. In places the color had faded or worn away. The net was dirty and sagged between the poles all the way to the ground. "Is the tennis court yours?" I asked him.
"I don't know," he said.
"Do you know how to play?" I asked.
"Nope," he said.
"I don't know either," I said. After the hot tub, we watched the red balloon, and then we watched Harold and Maud lying on our sides in his bed, him closer to the screen. I didn't like the red balloon, because it seemed too young and immature for me. Also, I had a feeling I was supposed to like it because he'd chosen it beforehand, the first movie, and this made me self-conscious. Harold and Maude, I loved. He paused the movie when I got up to pee.
"That's the church in Palo Alto," he said,
about the church where they meet. Both movies were on laser discs, which looked like bright silver records. He held the disc from the center and edge, not touching the surface, and when the player closed, it made a series of mechanical sounds. Four notes. The laser disc insertion, the hydraulic thump of the car doors, the click of the lever that controlled the headlights. The noises surrounding him were different. Beside his bed was a lamp with a cloth shade and gold-colored base. You only had to touch the base to turn the lamp on and off. I tried it a few times. Ingenious. Why didn't everyone have one? Why did we bother with switches and serrated knobs?
"Time to go to bed," he said after the movie ended.
Was it late? I couldn't tell. We existed outside regular time. The mornings with him, too, would have a timeless quality. More empty space and white light and silence. Unlike the mornings with my mother, when we raced to dress in front of the heaters and ate toast in the car on the way to school, the windshield mostly white, waiting for the heat to work. Here, there was no rush, no breathlessness. At night, the crickets made a roar I hadn't noticed before lying in the bed. The sound would advance toward me over the dark land, the dark lawn, the big dark house, and press against my ears. But just when I thought I'd be swallowed up, it would stop, empty. It was terrible and lonely, I felt then, to be in this cavernous house with this man I hardly knew. My mother had a string of lentil-sized bells on a ribbon she'd brought back from India, meant to be tied around the ankles of Indian dancers, and the crickets sounded like these bells. Thousands of dancers moving vigorously, almost in unison, faster and faster, until they all stopped at once. "Why don't you wear a watch?" I asked the next morning. I was already dressed for school. Fancy men wore watches.
"I don't want to be bound by time," he said.
"What's that?" I was looking out the kitchen window, pointing to a tall structure that looked like a booth for a ticket collector, with a screen in the front so you could see in, topped by a minaret.
"It's an aviary for birds."
"Are there birds inside?"
"No. A friend gave me a peacock once, but it wandered off."
"Will you get some birds to put in?" I asked.
"Nope."
I could tell he was getting annoyed by my questions. How big was 7 acres, I wondered. If you stood on the huge lawn and looked toward the gathered hills with your back to the tennis court and the pool, and looked past the aviary, past a huge copper beech tree, the raspberries, more oaks, the building where the water tower would have been, maybe that was where the property ended, where the hills rose up and the forest began.
"There,"
he'd said once, pointing, but I wasn't sure where he meant. He put 2 apples and a handful of almonds in a paper bag, a grocery bag, not a lunch bag, and rolled up the top.
"Here's your lunch," he said, handing it over.
The almonds rattled around at the bottom of the bag. I walked out ahead of him, through the pantry, the dining room, and into the huge room with the piano. On a small table in front of the couch was a coffee table book called The Red Couch. The pictures inside were of a worn, red velvet couch, upon which sat various famous people in different locations around the world. I flipped a page. And there he was. In the picture, he looked dreamy, his eyes like vellum. Unlike the others in the book, he steepled his hands, the fingertips meeting index to index, middle to middle, and so on, the wrists held out from each other like the rib cage of a small animal. Over the next few months, I tried to incorporate the steepled hands into my own repertoire, on top of my desk in class, or on the table before my mother and I ate dinner, or on my lap sitting outside with friends at lunchtime. I could never make it look natural. In that position, ballooned out, my hands felt huge and foolish. We walked out the door. "You don't lock it?" I asked.
"There's nothing to take," he said.
"You could get more furniture," I said. I imagined how grand the house could be if he'd just get some furniture. I wanted him to be attached to it so substantially that he wanted to decorate it and keep it. At school, we played a game called MASH. Mansion, apartment, shack, house. Writing down options about cars, husbands, and houses, and then counting out our futures based on a random number. I had first-hand knowledge of all four categories, even a shack, if you counted the studio on Oak Grove. My father had a mansion. I didn't know anyone else who could say that. Everyone wanted a mansion, and also the best kind of car, Porsche, Ferrari, Lamborghini. At the curve that led over Highway 280, my father said, "If you look where you're going, your hands naturally know how to steer toward that point. It's really amazing." He had no idea that I'd driven too, sitting on my mother's lap when I was six. For him, maybe I had no past. I was simply here, now, beside him. At the top of Sand Hill Road, he pointed to Hoover Tower sticking up past the roof lines. "Look," he said, "it's a penis." I wasn't sure what he meant.
"The penis of Palo Alto," he said. "Just look at it, with that red top."
The tower was glowing in the morning sun, and the dome at the top matched the red terracotta of the university rooftops. I'd been up there with my mother, near the bells and the pigeons and the wind. There was a net surrounding the bells so that the pigeons wouldn't roost inside them. "Oh," I said, laughing a little, trying to make the connection between this structure and the very few penises I'd seen, skin-colored cylinders that dangled down.
"It looks like a penis," he said again, defiantly.
"I'm going to die in my early 40s, my father said to me around this time. He'd come to pick me up at a friend's house for the first time. His delivery was dramatic, as if to stir some action. But there was no action I could see to take. 40 seemed pretty old from my vantage point of 8. I was secretly happy he'd confided in me, pleased by the implication that we'd have more time together. 4 to 9 years. I already knew he'd predicted both his fame and his early demise. My mother had told me about it. Did he think we didn't talk about him in his absence? The serious way he spoke suggested he thought that for all those years he'd been gone, we didn't think of him or talk about him. As if when he left a room, the room ceased to exist. Anyway, his pronouncement didn't seem tragic, but uplifting. I'd take a few years over none at all. He was great. And great people, like JFK, like Lenin, died young. I didn't know about that, but he did. On the drive to his house that night, he said, "It used to be orchards, all of this. Now the land was roads and low huddled buildings that looked like they'd always been there. When I die, bury me under an apple tree," he said. I remembered to remember later. He repeated this often when we were alone, and I figured I would have the responsibility to make it happen. Unboxed, he meant, so the roots could drink him up. The next two Wednesdays were similar. The drive to his house with the top down and the heater on, an assortment of cold salads and juice, a hot tub, a movie on Laserdisc, North by Northwest, Modern Times, City Lights. Before we watched one, he would ask me if I'd ever seen the movie before. When I said no, he'd shake his head. "Seriously, in silence, like it was some big mistake. Each time I had to pee during a movie, he paused it. The night of the third visit, I wet the bed and woke up mortified that the people who made the beds would tell him about it. A couple lived in a small house on the land, made the salads, and washed the sheets. I was almost 9. I hadn't wet a bed for many years. But the next week, the bed was made again, and he didn't mention it. Before dinner, we played Heart and Soul on the piano, alternating parts. I think it was the only song either of us knew how to play. The notes rang out in the large, empty room. After I was in bed, I waited as many minutes as possible, building up my courage in the cricket-jangling darkness, then emerged from my bedroom and walked to the end of his bed, fake crying. Maybe I got the idea from Annie? A girl ingratiating herself with a gruff man, standing over my father in my sleep t-shirt, looking down at him in his bed on the floor. I was aware of being small and using what I had as a girl. Inspiring love, I thought, had to do with being defenseless. For him to be close with me, like other fathers with their daughters, he needed to love me. Also, his bed was more comfortable than mine. He removed his headphones and looked at me. He watched movies with a big pair of headphones after I went to bed. "I had a nightmare," I said. "Can I sleep in your bed?" "I guess so," he said, and pointed to the side farther away from the television. I jumped in and the pillow dissolved under the weight of my head, as if it were made of nothing. My request seemed to annoy rather than charm him. I hoped this might change over time. He was not the father I'd imagined from the skeleton of facts I'd known. Yes, there was an elevator and a piano and an organ. He was rich and famous and handsome. But none of this satisfied completely. It was tempered by an unmistakable emptiness I felt near him. A feeling of a vast loneliness. The stair behind the kitchen with no light. The wind coming through from the rickety balcony. It was supposed to be what I wanted. But it was not possible to enjoy as I'd hoped. As if it were a sumptuous feast frozen solid. He woke me up in the morning by shaking my shoulder very quickly like a pulse. "Rise and shine," he said. I pulled on my clothes, and as he was getting ready, I explored, opening a door off his bedroom and peering into what turned out to be a closet with a row of suits hung on matching hangers, the sleeves in a perfect horizontal row. Unlike the rest of this house, these suits had been chosen and collected. You could tell they were new and expensive. Not one sleeve lower or higher than another. I ran my hand along the rounds of fabric where the sleeves ended, each of them so soft and light, it felt like I was brushing my hand over ridges of water in a stream. "Ingrid Bergman's incredibly beautiful," he said the next week while we watched Casablanca. "Did you know she didn't wear any makeup? She was that beautiful." I liked her lips. How they were flat and full and formed a ledge where they met her cheeks. I liked her accent and the way she swayed gently as she walked. It seemed my father's idea of beauty demanded no artifice. It simply was. Although, looking back, I think she must have been wearing mascara, at least. I liked women who wore lipstick and makeup and fancy clothes and long painted fingernails and hairspray. Those, to me, were beautiful. It gave me a strange feeling when he talked of the beauty of other women. The longing in his voice when he talked of blonde hair or of breasts, gesturing weights in his cupped hands. When he talked about them, they were all details, no movement, exempt from the mess of life. I would be truly loved by him only if I was tall, blonde, and large-breasted, I would gather later. I had a fantastic notion that it might happen despite the evidence. "You know, I heard this great story about Ingrid Bergman once," he said. "But it's kind of a secret, so you can't tell." We'd finished watching the movie and he was putting the laser disc into its case. "I won't tell, I promise," I said. "I have this friend," he said, His father was a movie producer. And when he was a boy, Ingrid Bergman came to stay at his house. They had a pool, and she was lying on a chair beside it. My father was crouched on the side of the bed near the television. When he told gossip and secrets, he used better diction and spoke more rapidly. "Well," he continued, "it turns out Ingrid Bergman liked to sunbathe in the nude, and my friend, who was a boy then, whose bedroom looked out over the pool, was watching her. And then she was, well, she was..." He trailed off. I had absolutely no idea what he was talking about. "Anyway," he said, "the moment it happened, the climax, she looked up at him, right at him." "Oh," I said. What had she done? What did he watch? Why was she naked? I mean, the friend is my age now, as if to clarify. "Anyway, for him, it must have been incredible," he said, shaking his head and looking down, smiling to himself. He repeated this story several times over many years, each time telling me he'd heard a great story and a huge secret, forgetting he'd told me before. At some point around that time, with my new allowance, $5 per week, I bought a navy blue eyeliner pencil and brought it over to his house. In the morning before we left for school, while he waited for me, I went into the bathroom and leaned against the sink so I was close to the mirror and tried to apply it to an eyelid. "Come on," he said, holding the screen, standing out on the balcony. "1 minute," I said. The liner was waxy and didn't set down like pencil on paper. I was afraid of making it too dark, so I drew it on very lightly, almost imperceptibly. I'd heard my mother say that makeup was good when it was not obvious. I was giddy with the idea that he would realize how sophisticated I was. My hand shook. At the door, I asked if he noticed anything on my eyes. He leaned down. "Nope," he said. "Good," I said. "You're not supposed to see it."
"See what?"
"Eyeliner," I said. "I put some on."
"Go wash it off," he said, angry. "Now."
"Look at the sky," my mother said. She was driving us home. "Isn't it incredible?" Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a stripe of hot pink clouds running over the telephone wires and glowing gold leaves on the sycamore trees beside the road. "I guess," I said. My mother felt color acutely. It was one of the ways we communicated, her driving around the town, pointing out colors. She'd broken up with Ron, and although I was initially relieved to be rid of him and have my mother to myself again, now I wasn't so sure. I'd found him annoying, but once he was gone, I missed him. Ron had been variety, someone else besides my mother and me. When he walked into our house, he disturbed the air. Men brought life. You couldn't take the measure of it until they were gone and left everything flat, without zest or surprise. We couldn't afford to go out for dinner or to the museum in San Francisco. Now, in the car, she wanted me to look at the sky. "Look up," she said. "What's wrong with you?" I slouched in my seat like the flare of color was the most boring thing in the world. It seemed to me it would take too much energy to appreciate every phenomenon she pointed out. It was just sunset. We'd seen a lot of them already. Already, life had begun to repeat. Kirsten invited me to her house to spend the night. She was the girl who'd followed me around announcing my father's name. Since then, she'd stopped doing that, and we were part of the same group of friends at school. We had permission to walk from school to her dad's house, which was north past University Avenue, the opposite side of Palo Alto from where I lived. It was a privilege to be able to walk that far alone, without an adult. Her house was a Victorian with a cement path leading up to the wooden steps. Tree roots snaked and strained through the dirt yard like neck tendons. Her bedroom was under the eaves at the top of the house, the ceiling tucked into the floor. She had her own small television. I sat down on the bed and it shifted around me like jello, a surprise. "It's a waterbed," she said, stretching out. There was something exotic about her, and slippery, that made me feel conservative and ordinary. I also got sleepy around her. The way I would get sleepy around people who cared about my father being famous. We went downstairs, where I followed her into the kitchen. She pulled a big carrot out of the fridge. You know what some women do with these, right? She said. Put it inside them, instead of having sex. That's gross, I said. The world contained disgusting, revolting elements, like sex, which I knew about, and which still felt unsettling. How people might be doing it and yet continuing to exist in an ordinary fashion on the surface. Like an infestation of bugs under a clean white wall. Look, she said, pulling out a black gauzy string from her chest of drawers. It was a bra made of elasticized lace, two triangles bound by black strips of lycra. It looked like a woman's bra. Sexy for a grown-up. It's small, made for a child. I'd had no idea something this perfect existed in the world, in these proportions. It was tantalizing for being a perfect miniature, the way dollhouse furniture, food, and cutlery had been thrilling to me before. I wanted all of what she had. The remote, the television, the waterbed, the lacy bra. Hey, you want to watch the Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Okay, I said. I wasn't sure what it was. She took a tape out of a worn paper case, pushed it into the VHS player under her television. The film was grainy like a sweater woven out of too many colors of yarn. I could make out only the figure of a man walking up a path in dry grasses toward a house. I watch this a lot, she said, before I go to sleep. Before we turned off the light, her father came in to check on us. Dad, Kirsten said. He sat down on the edge of the bed facing her. I'm feeling insecure, she said in a baby voice. You told me to tell you when I was feeling like that, and I'm telling you now. Oh, honey, he said. He hugged her close. I'd had no idea she was feeling insecure. I was impressed she knew that word, and jealous that she could say something like this to her father. It was an adult word. I wouldn't have thought to say it, ever. Sorry, dear, he said, and then stood up and looked at both of us. Well, good night, you two. Sleep tight. The stairs creaked on his way down. In the morning, just before my mother came to pick me up, after Kirsten had gone down to the kitchen, I found the bra in the thicket of rumpled cotton in the top drawer and stuffed it into my backpack. By the fifth visit to his house, I was impatient. For a long time, I hoped that if I played one role, my father would take the corresponding role. I would be the beloved daughter. He would be the indulgent father. I decided that if I acted like other daughters, he would join in the lark. We'd pretend together, and in pretending, we'd make it real. But if I had observed him as he was, or admitted to myself what I saw, I would have known that he would not do this, and that a game of pretend would disgust him. Now we were together in his car driving to the Woodside house in the dark. Tonight he wore a leather jacket with black fabric at the cuffs that matched the color of his hair and gave him a rakish look. He was still quiet, but I felt bolder. Can I have it when you're done? I asked him, as we took a left at the leaning, crumbling white pillars that flanked the thin, bumpy road that ended at his gate. I'd been thinking about it for a while, but only just built up the courage to ask. Can you have what? He said. This car? Your Porsche? I wondered where he put the extras. I pictured them in a shiny black line at the back of his land. Absolutely not. He said in such a sour, biting way that I knew I'd made a mistake. I understood that perhaps it wasn't true. The myth of the scratch. Maybe he didn't buy a new one with abandon. Maybe the idea that he was profligate was false. He was not generous with money, food, or words. The idea of the Porsches had seemed like one glorious exception. I wished I could take it back. We pulled up to the house and he turned off the engine. Blue hydrangeas with flowers bigger than my head billowed out from both sides of the gate to the courtyard. Many years later, he would quiz me. What do you think is the best kind of hydrangea? The blue ones. The bright blue ones.
I used to think so, too, when I was young, he said. But it turns out the white ones, the cone-shaped ones, are actually much nicer.
Before I made a move to get out, he turned to face me.
You're not getting anything, he said. You understand? Nothing. You're getting nothing.
Did he mean about the car? Something else? Bigger? I didn't know. His voice hurt, sharp in my chest. The light was cool in the car. A white light on the roof had lit up when the engine turned off. Around us was dark. I had made a terrible mistake, and he'd recoiled. By then, the idea that he'd named the failed computer after me was woven in with my sense of self, even if he did not confirm it. And I used this story to bolster myself when, near him, I felt like nothing. I didn't care about computers. They were made of fixed metal parts and chips with glinting lines inside plastic cases. They mesmerized you when you sat in front of them, but were otherwise boring to look at, not beautiful. But I liked the idea that I was connected to him in this way. It would mean I'd been chosen and had a place, despite the fact that he was aloof or absent. It meant I was fastened to the earth and its machines. He was famous. He drove a Porsche. If the Lisa was named after me, I was a part of all that. I see now that we were at cross purposes. For him, I was a blot on a spectacular ascent, as our story did not fit with the narrative of greatness and virtue he might have wanted for himself. My existence ruined his streak. For me, it was the opposite. The closer I was to him, the less I would feel ashamed. He was part of the world, and he would accelerate me into the light. It might all have been a big misunderstanding, a missed connection. He'd simply forgotten to mention the computer was named after me. I was shaking with the need to set it right all at once, as if waiting for a person to arrive for a surprise party, to switch on the lights and yell out what I'd held in. Once he'd admitted it, "Yes, I named a computer after you," everything would click into place. He would patch the holes, get furniture. Say he'd been thinking of me the whole time, but had been unable to get to me. Yet I also sensed that if I tried too hard to set it right, it might tip some delicate balance, and he would be gone again. And so I waited in the suspended state in order to keep him. I followed him from the car into the house. We didn't take a hot tub. We ate salads as he read the paper. We watched Flashdance. I didn't try to sleep in his bed. At some point, I awoke in the dark because I had to pee. The darkness pressing on my eyes, nothing visible. It was silent. The crickets had stopped. I wouldn't be able to find the bathroom in the pitch black. I couldn't even tell what direction I was facing or whether I was upright. I waited with my eyes open in the darkness and nothing emerged. It was as if the darkness were pressing back at my efforts to penetrate it. To get to the bathroom, I would have to walk through his room, down a few more steps in a hallway that led to another empty room, and off that, the bathroom. I crawled out of the bed and found the doorframe, also chalky, half there, but now shapes emerged with more clarity. And I saw that in his bed across the room was someone with bright blonde hair. It was a man who had come to kill my father. He'd killed him already and was now sleeping in his bed. I already knew what this new man was like with his shining white hair, phony and full of blandishments. He'd say he was my new father, but he would be nothing like my father. I couldn't see his face, but I was terrified. The blonde hair glowed in the dark. I could hear my breath. I worried for my real father. After I crept to the bathroom, I crept back through the room and the blonde man was still there in the bed. He moved in his sleep, diving down under the covers as if plunging underwater. I returned to my bed and spent what felt like hours terrified, wondering what to do, dreading the morning when it would be clear that my life would be different forever and my father would be gone. I was too afraid to get up again and confront the blonde man. I decided to wait until morning, and at some point I must have fallen asleep. In the morning, there was no blonde man, and my father was alive. I thought I must have imagined it. I didn't ask him about it. I was embarrassed for the terror I'd felt, and the protectiveness. The next Wednesday night, my mother drove over to visit us when her class was unexpectedly canceled. We didn't know she was coming. She found us in the kitchen, having knocked and called out, and then entered through the unlocked front door, walking through the dark house into the bright and cold kitchen where we were sitting, eating. She sat with us as he teased me in the usual ways.
"How about that guy for your boyfriend?"
he said, pointing to a picture of an old man in the paper he was reading while we ate. I looked, then sneezed, and a few grains of the salad flew onto the picture.
"The boys will love that. You'll have that bed warmed up in no time at all," he said,
about a new bed Mona was planning to buy for me.
"Who you gonna invite over?"
The jokes were profoundly awkward. He was refined in other ways, but seemed unsure about how you were supposed to talk with children. I wanted to be close with him, but the jokes confused me. I didn't know how to respond. That might have been the look she saw on my face. Later she said his jokes that night, his avuncular manner, and my obvious discomfort in the kitchen had surprised her. "I had a look of being lost," she said, "not confident the way I usually was." She arranged for me to stay at a friend's house on those Wednesday nights, telling me that he planned to come and take me skating instead. I thought that sounded okay. Small fry. Our next house would be the place we'd lived the longest during my childhood. 7 years. A craftsman bungalow on Rinconada Avenue in Palo Alto. The only house on the lot, with 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, and a separate garage my mother would later transform into an art studio. It was a real house, painted light yellow with royal blue trim, a blue door. It was symmetrical from the front, with a cement path that bisected the lawn, and dirt patches under 2 front windows where my mother would plant multicolored impatiens. An arbutus tree grew on one side of the driveway, with scaly, twisting bark and fruits we did not yet know would ripen and fall onto the lawn in the autumn rains and burst open, leaving a slimy orange jelly we would be forever wiping off our shoes. The side door opened to a thick bower of wisteria that smelled of soap and candy when it bloomed and attracted bees. Before we moved in, a man who worked for my father at Next as facilities manager helped renovate the rental house. He was a kind, beanpole-tall man who stooped down to talk to me, telling me that I was allowed to pick out the shape of the bathroom sink and the linoleum for the floor. He had a high laugh and a large, sharp Adam's apple that bobbed alarmingly up and down his neck. Under his direction, the house was repainted on the inside. The wood floors were refinished and stained blonde. Linoleum was laid in the bathrooms and kitchen. Metal Venetian blinds were attached to the windows. In the bathroom, the sink I'd chosen belled out, regally, at the top. My mother bought a set of encyclopedias with pictures of a gold thistle on the spines, and when there was a question about something, she would rush over and pull one off the bookshelf, dividing the gold-painted seal across the pages to read the relevant section aloud. She had a walk-in closet. It wasn't big, and maybe it wasn't big enough to fit the definition of the phrase walk-in closet, but because it was large enough to get inside and turn around, that's what we called it. There were bars for hangers and wire shelves for clothes. She also had her own small bathroom with a skylight. One day, standing in her bathroom, she showed me her new wallet. "It's from Neiman Marcus," she said. I examined it under the skylight. Shades of taupe skin made of strips sewn together vertically. Darker in the middle than at the edge. wrinkled at the center of each strip as if a thread was yanked to form tucks. It was the softest leather I'd felt, and waxy.
"It's eel skin," she said.
"Isn't that terrible?
Eels!"
"It's like silk," I said. "Or butter."
"I know. And look at this."
She showed me the metal snap, the size of a dime. I could feel it was a magnet. It found itself and pulled shut. As far as I knew, she'd never owned a wallet before. These luxuries, the wallet, skylight closet, a new microwave that spun the food as it cooked, a cordless phone, suggested that some great change was brewing, that we were entering a new, more exquisite realm. It turned out that my father had increased the child support payments to include a larger amount of rent and maintenance. Soon, he would also agree to pay for her therapy once per week. She couldn't afford to replace the couch, but she got it recovered in more muted flowers. My father stopped by a few times, just after the renovations. He and my mother seemed easy with each other, joking and admiring the house, both of them liking the shade of paint inside, the new industrial light fixtures, two white metal bars over a ridged frosted glass shade, fixtures that were meant for outdoors, but looked good inside too. When my parents were together, I felt something inside me click into place, like the magnet clasp. A few times during that first year in the house, when it was still new and perfect around us, she would walk in the front door and stop and gasp, putting her hand on her heart, at the beauty of a gold parallelogram made of light glowing on the wall above the heater vent. Over the years in that house, my mother told stories about my father and her family when they occurred to her, or I asked about them. She said my father was so shy and awkward in high school that when he would talk or tell a joke, no one would listen. He had made my mother a kite and a pair of sandals. When they lived together that summer at the end of Stevens Canyon Road in the house with the goats, they slept under quilts my mother's grandmother from Ohio had made, and for a treat, they ate those cheap miniature hot dogs out of jars. At some point that summer, my mother said, they were down to their last $3, and they drove to the beach, where my father threw the money into the ocean. "I was terrified," she said. "But then he sold more of the blue boxes, and we had money again." The story of my parents is not complete without a picture of my mother's disintegrating family life, of how, after the family arrived in California when she was 12, her mother became mentally ill. Her parents, Jim and Virginia, had moved the family west when my grandfather's employer, the Department of Defense, transferred him from Dayton, Ohio, where she was born and both her grandmothers lived, to Colorado Springs, then to Omaha, Nebraska, and finally to California. In California, Virginia was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and my mother's parents divorced. My mother spoke of Ohio like a lost paradise. In Ohio, her grandmothers had made quilts and doted on her, let her play with the skin on the back of their hands. One of them had a farm and a chicken coop, where my mother ran to collect eggs in the morning. The time before her mother went crazy, any time my mother pointed out some beauty around us that looked established and grand, gold dusk light stretched across brick buildings with pillars, great trees, she named the beauty Ohio. In California, Virginia would sit in the darkened living room drunk, smoking, the only visible thing the lit tip of her cigarette, waiting for her daughters to get home from school. My mother was only a little older than I was now when Virginia aimed much of her spite and contempt at her. Maybe because my mother, sensitive, artistic, and bright, reminded her most of herself. When my mother was 12, Virginia accused her of playing the recorder only because it reminded her of a penis, and Virginia told the neighbors that my mother had sex with dogs. When my mother met my father in high school, what impressed her most were his kind eyes, compared with her own mother's eyes, which by then were hateful dark sparks. The third time I visited Steve's house in high school, his mother took me aside. She told me that in his first 6 months, she was afraid she might lose him because his birth mother wanted him back, and she couldn't allow herself to get close to him. At the time, I had no idea why she was telling me this, my mother said. I was just a high school student. It wasn't like I thought I'd known him that long. She told the story as if it meant something, but I wasn't sure what it meant. They fell in love. My father wrote long notes to Virginia and left them on her front door, telling Virginia she was cruel, imploring her to stop being cruel to my mother. My father was my mother's savior then, noticing her talent, beauty, and sensitivity, caring for her when her own mother was violent and insane. "You're the most creative person I've ever met," he told her. My parents took LSD together. His first time, not hers. The drug took a while to kick in, she said, so you just waited around, and then at some point you realized the world wasn't normal anymore and the trip had started. The idea of my mother doing drugs made me squirm, but she said, "Don't worry, Lisa. It was just a time, a different era." She said he was terrified of making a fool of himself on drugs. Made her promise to tell him to snap out of it in case he got weird. That was around the time my father told my mother he'd get famous and rich one day and lose himself in the world. "What do you mean, lose himself?" I asked her. I pictured him confused in the middle of a crowd. "I mean, lose his moral compass," she said. "Trade his character, his soul, for power, for money, for worldly gain. Contort himself. Lose the connection to his soul." Beside the house where they lived together over the summer before he left for college was another bungalow with a couple of kids in their 20s from a rich family. They did a lot of drugs and sat around waiting for their parents to die so they could get their inheritance. This left a big impression on both of my parents, how people could waste their lives. Years later, she would tell me the story as a way to explain why my father wouldn't help me with money, repeating the story of those lazy, lost children he'd seen and didn't want me to become. "When were your parents divorced?" other kids would ask me. "They were never married," I said. I liked saying it. It was usually a surprise, disarming the questioner. It gave me distinction. Instead of a dad who was around and then left, mine was a story in reverse. Parents who spent more time together now than they'd spent when I was born. Now on weekends when he was around, my father came over to take me skating on my own. My mother staying home to paint, waving goodbye to us as we set off. He called me Small Fry. "Hey, Small Fry, let's blast. We're living on borrowed time." I assumed Small Fry meant the kind of French fries left at the bottom of the bag, cold and crusty. I thought he was calling me a runt or misbegotten. Later, I learned fry is an old word for young fishes sometimes thrown back into the sea to give them more time to grow. "Okay, fat fry, let's go," I said once my skates were on. Sometimes he worried he was getting too thin. "They say I need to gain weight," he said. "Who?" I asked. "People at work," he said, standing in the middle of the room with his skates on. "What do you guys think?" Other times he worried he was getting a paunch and asked us about that, too. We would head for Stanford University. On this day, the pavement was still wet from rain. The palm trees that gave Palm Drive its name grew in the dirt between the sidewalk and the road, the roots winding beneath the old cement path so the cement was ridged severely and layered over several times in messy, uneven layers. But these hadn't worked to hold down the roots, each layer buckling up. We bounced our knees to absorb the shock. Fronds had fallen from the trees, sometimes blocking the path, so we had to step around them into the dirt on our skates. The missing fronds left a pattern on the trunks like fishes, stacked. "I wish I'd been a Native American Indian," he said, looking up at the hills beyond the university. From far away, they appeared smooth and unblemished. The neon green blades shot up through the dirt clods 2 or 3 days after the first heavy rain and remained through winter.
They walked barefoot, you know, he said.